Hello and welcome to The Rest is History. Now, Tom, it does feel a little bit like every moment of our lives is Rest is History recordings or performances at the moment,
it does
doesn't
slightly
it?
Slightly at the moment.
But
yes.
We are coming off the back of our Rest is History weekend. We had our Athelstan party on Saturday night. So those of you who are the Athelstan members, we saw loads of you. And then we did two shows at the Clapham Grand in London on Sunday. Tom, how did you feel they went?
I loved the Athelstan meeting. It was great meeting all the Athelstans. But it was also great meeting the cardboard cutout of Athelstan.
You took it home.
I did. I thought that was a wonderful thing. I was very excited about that. I did take it home and it's standing in my sitting room as I speak.
Oh, that's nice. It was a really fun evening. We met upstairs at a pub. So for those of you who are not Athelstans, I think there were about 80 people there, Tom, something like that, 80 to 100 people there. We did a little Q&A.
And as always, it's great, isn't it, to put faces to the names that you see on the Discord or whatever.
Yeah.
And we had people who came all the way from America.
We did indeed.
Mary Clark Alves and Amy Mantravardi. We had people from Belgium, people from the Netherlands.
We did.
So wonderful.
Yeah, and people who travelled down from all over Britain. I mean, it was really fun. Everybody seemed to get on pretty well, which is amazing, really, because you've got people from different generations, different walks of life.
Different opinions on Brexit.
Very different opinions on Brexit. That's all bizarrely discussed reasonably civilly, though after drink had been taken, I think it's fair to say, Tom.
Yes.
But no, it's very jolly. So we did that. We loved seeing the Athelstans. And then the next day we did our two performances at the Clapham Grand, which unfortunately we didn't record. I mean, it'd be very difficult to record them because they were quite interactive.
Yeah. And there were a lot of pictures, weren't there?
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff
video
on the screen.
And stuff.
Exactly.
Because if you're coming to a live show, obviously we want to give you something that you wouldn't get just listening to a podcast. I mean, that's the whole point of doing it.
Yeah, exactly right. So Stephen Clark asked, is it going to appear as a podcast? And the answer basically, Stephen, I think is no. But the good news is, for those of you who missed it, we're going to do live shows next spring. We haven't got it completely ironed out.
So we're going Edinburgh, Manchester,
well, we're still
Birmingham.
Debating it, I think, aren't they? But these are the plans. We'll do some sort of tour in Britain. And then hopefully at some point, we would love to go to America. We would love to go to Europe. And of course, we'd love to go to Australia because I know we do have quite a lot of American, Australian, you know, Dutch,
well,
Belgian listeners.
The extraordinary statistic, which I think reflects tremendously well on Australia.
Yeah.
That Tony and Jack can break down the diagnostics and work out which city has the most listeners. And London, unsurprisingly, has the most. But I think the second is Sydney and the third is Melbourne.
I think that's right.
So
that's absolutely right.
Australia, give yourself a huge pat on the back.
And number four, I think, is New York.
Yeah.
So, but we do have quite a good European following. So I would love to do shows in Europe as well. And actually, the lovely thing about those live shows, Tom, is that even in the audience there were lots of familiar sort of faces that we'd seen or people coming up at the end and saying,
yeah,
you know, I'm so-and-so on Twitter or whatever. So we're all about community, aren't we?
Yeah.
This podcast.
All about community.
We're very much about...
All about community.
Inclusion, kindness. That's what I stand for, always have, as everybody knows.
You're unapologetic about it, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're not going to apologize for it.
No.
Being
no.
Nice. That's exactly. What you're all about.
Yeah. Well, it's what everybody associates. Ask anybody in a British university history department. What do you associate with Dominic Sambrook? And they say...
Kindness.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Diversity.
Yeah. It's what you're all about.
And compassion.
So, Dominic.
Yes.
As well as doing live shows and meeting Athelstans, obviously we've been continuing doing the recording of all our various World Cup episodes.
So today we did, I mean, Tom, does this give you a sense of how Tom Holland's mind works? We had two shows at the Clapham Grand and we had, I think, 2 hours between them in which we were expected to have our photos taken. Eat, drink, you know, prepare ourselves for the next show, say goodbye to our, or hello to our respective families, all these kinds of things. And Tom said, I think we've got time to do a quick World Cup episode or two.
Dominic, it was a joke.
The producers, judging by the way the blood drained.
Well, I like to keep them on their toes.
Yeah. So anyway, no, we did two this morning.
We're closing in, aren't we? So yeah, so we did United States and its relationship to Britain, to England.
Yeah.
Which I think is fun.
It's six
episodes from Anglo-American history.
Let's not tell them what they are, though. Tom. Let's keep them up our sleeve.
Okay, so one of them is a kind of obvious one.
He's going to
tell
you.
But the other five,
yeah.
I don't think you'll get them.
If you get them, yeah, I'd be absolutely astounded. And the other one was Switzerland. So, Tom, you took the lead on Switzerland.
Switzerland, yeah.
I think you can tell them what that is.
So that's the burning of Michael Servetus, who was a heretic who went to Geneva at a time when it was ruled by Calvin. Well, it wasn't ruled by Calvin, but it was very much under the thumb of Calvin. And Calvin and Servetus hated each other. And the upshot of that, one of the great dramatic episodes in the history of the Reformation. So I hope you will all enjoy that. And of course, Dominic, this week we've put out the three episodes on the history of the World Cup.
We have indeed.
So yes. Again, you should have them all.
Yeah. I really enjoyed doing those. I went to give a talk yesterday, Tom, at Stephen Clark School. So Stephen Clark, who's always been a great friend and booster of the show. He's, of course, a history teacher. I have to say he's not without a dog in the rest of history fight because I was at university with his brother.
Okay.
And in fact, his brother came with me on the stag trip to Minsk.
The famous one, yes.
So when Stephen Clark introduced me to something like, 150 year sevens yesterday, he opened with The Rest Is History Live, which he'd very much enjoyed, and the stag trip to Minsk. And actually, Tom, later on I did a thing for his sixth formers, and you'll be delighted to hear this. Mm-hmm. One of the questions was, if I want to listen to The Rest Is History, where should I start? And Stephen recommended the Rubicon episodes.
Oh, what a wonderful man he is.
What a kind, that's kindness for you, isn't it?
I don't think it's kindness. I think it's...
It's astuteness.
It's astute.
Well, anyway, I can't remember. It's so Stephen Clark said, he said he loved the World Cup episodes, Tom. He said, Tom does not need to apologize for the subject. It's a great subject. So there you go.
I think that's probably true, but it's just I had so many people on Twitter basically, much less so the Discord, saying, oh, football, World Cup, not going to listen to this, really boring.
Yeah.
And it really isn't boring. And I don't think you need, I'm not going to go do it all again, but you don't need to be interested in football to find it.
No, I mean, if you're interested in President Mobutu in Zaire, in Mussolini, in 20th century Brazil, you can listen to all those things.
And the same is true of theology.
Yeah.
You know, I always have to apologize for it. Because people say, oh, I'm not interested in it.
All right, now we've had a few shocking comments. Do you want to read out that first comment?
Yeah, so Whiskery.
Yeah.
I never miss an opportunity to correct people on this mistake, but Hungary were not the first team to beat England. In England, they were the first to beat them at Wembley. Ireland beat England 2-0 in a friendly played at Goodison Park in 1949. I'm guessing Whiskery may well be Irish himself.
I had a couple of comments along these lines from Irish, and I pointed out that if it's a friendly played at Goodison Park, it doesn't count as being played in England.
I mean, obviously, Dominic, I knew that. And even as you said that, I thought, should I correct him? I don't want to embarrass him.
That is an absolute, yeah, right. But don't tell me, Jonathan Wilson told you that over dinner, did he?
No, of course, everyone knows that. I just didn't want to show up your lack of footballing knowledge.
Sam the Burgundian Wang, who was at the Athelstan gathering, asks an excellent question. When will you do a podcast on the history of Wolverhampton Wanderers? You know, a proper, hard-working, roast beef-eating football team. A history of the Wolves would also nicely tie in with the rise and fall and resurrection of the English Midlands while pouring scorn over Chelsea and the likes. Well, I'll say a couple of things. First of all, I'm not sure actually the rise, fall and resurrection of the Midlands is quite right, because anybody who's been to Wolverhampton in recent years will know that it's a city very much on its uppers at the moment. I mean, the city centre feels very Minsk-like, I'm sorry to say. We will probably never do an episode on the history of Wolverhampton Wanderers. However, there is something in Sam's message that we will be doing an episode on, and that is roast beef.
Yeah.
We will be doing an episode in the next few weeks about beef and liberty and beef and Englishness.
Could we not at some point do a paired episode on Aston Villa and Wolverhampton Wanderers?
I think it would be on the two of them.
Hmm.
I suppose
kind of,
we could.
You know, industrial Midlands in late 19th century. I mean, they're both very historic clubs. I mean, one of them more historic than the other.
Well, they're both founder members of the Football League. I think we could do an episode about the history of... We are doing an episode about the history of Birmingham and Richard Viner, but I think we could do some sort of walking tour, maybe. So there's a lot of history there.
Did you know my great uncle had a trial for Villa?
No, I didn't know that, Tom.
Yeah, he did. And a trial for Warwickshire Cricket
Club. I did not know that.
As well as competing in the Olympics and being the first Englishman to compete in the Tour de France.
Very impressive, Tom. Mm-hmm. Very impressive. I mean, I've never doubted your lineage.
So you can see where I get my sporting ability.
Tony Bang is after merchandise. He liked the first two World Cup episodes, but he wants t-shirts that say, "You are scum and sons of whores."
So that's Mobutu, isn't it?
Is that Mobutu talking to?
Yeah, that's Mobutu to his man management skills. Basically telling the team, Zaire, after they've lost 9-0, that if they lose by more than 3 goals to Brazil, they will be fed to crocodiles.
So Tony Bang asks a question. Footballer phobes, temporarily avert your ears. He says, what's your favourite World Cup, Tom?
Oh, my favourite World Cup.
And you're not allowed to say the Cricket World Cup.
Well, yes, of course, England won the T20 on Sunday. So that was great. So reading about them, I think the 1978 one is the most extraordinary.
The Argentine Junta.
I mean, incredibly dramatic.
Yeah.
I think the one I would have enjoyed watching the most is 74.
The Dutch. You're all about the Dutch.
Yeah, total football.
Yeah.
But also you've got West Germany against East Germany. That's great.
Yeah.
You've got Haiti.
Yeah.
You've got Zaire.
Yeah.
I think great.
Scotland.
You've got Scotland, yeah.
So when we publicised these, I had sort of Scottish people on social media contacting me and saying, please tell me you're not going to do Scotland. Because, I mean, people who are outsiders to this whole story will just not know this, but Scotland has an incredibly proud footballing history. I mean, Scotland and England played the very first fixture, and Scotland were absolute pioneers in passing the ball. So when football began, it was just sort of boot the ball down the field, charge after it, lots of violence and mud and public school spirit. And the Scots played the English, and they actually kicked the ball to each other, which the English thought was disgraceful.
Cheating.
But the Scots played, you know, beautiful football, and they basically invented, you know, you could argue they invented the game that is played today. But Scotland have always performed ludicrously badly at World Cup, so they will often go with high hopes. And the most famous example of that, and it is a history story as much as a sporting story, is in 1978. So at quite a high point of Scottish nationalism, North Sea Oil is about to come on stream. And this really is the moment that if Scotland wanted to be independent, this was its kind of window of opportunity, really. And there's a great movement for Scottish devolution in the 70s. There's a real sense of Scottish kind of cultural nationalism. And Scotland had an excellent team, very, very good players. They qualified for the two successive World Cups that England did not qualify for, 74 and 78. And in 1978, they really have a tremendous sense of excitement. They had a gigantic send-off. I think it's at Hampden Park in Glasgow, their big stadium, where people packed into the stands to see them off, basically cheering as if you'd won the World Cup. The manager, who was a chap called Ali McLeod, he delighted in baiting the English papers. You know, he said, basically, we're going to win the World Cup. You know, you can say the day after you might as well say it's a national holiday now, the day after we return. And people would say to him jokingly, what will you do after you've won the World Cup? And he said, well, we'll win it again. I'll build a cabinet to hold the World Cup. He was doing all this sort of stuff. So the Scots leave in this enormous, enormous sort of cloud of self-promotion. And then they arrived in Argentina and everything went disastrously wrong. They lost to Peru. They drew with Iran. And then they have this incredible Pyrrhic victory over the Netherlands, 3-2. And they don't quite qualify. And for Scotland, I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that this was a culturally traumatic moment, because the English laughed at them so much. And people genuinely, you read books on this and people will genuinely say that set back the cause of Scottish independence kind of 10 years. This humiliation on the world stage, because...
Or do you think that it amplified Anglo-Scottish mutual hostility?
Oh, yes.
That the English did not behave sympathetically?
I mean, in my chapter on this, in my book Seasons in the Sun, I end it with columns from the Daily Mirror and the Daily Express, which were purportedly British national newspapers, which should have been sympathetic, you know, for Scottish readers, that are glorying, absolutely laughing at it, saying, you know, they've got what they deserved, they're so mean-spirited.
But that's because England hadn't qualified.
Yes.
So it's kind of resentment and bit
of course,
and envy.
Of course, of course. I mean, the last line, let me just...
We're getting a live reading from Dominic's
book. Yeah, you're getting a live reading. Isn't this exciting? So to sort of give you a sense, I mean, I've done some live reading. People wrote into the Daily Express, Mrs. R.W. Beard of Cornwall, I'm sick of the whole boasting, bragging, loudmouth pack of them, i.e. the Scots. The Scots had rammed themselves down our throats, agreed G. Bevan of London. I don't suppose they've learned their lesson, but it gives the rest of us a chance to have a go at them for a change. And the Daily Express says that the Scots had massive sponsorship deals. it's been suggested that because they perform so badly, the Scottish players should make personal monetary contribution out of their sponsorship deals to those dedicated people who travel so far and at such expense to support them. And a leader column, Tom, an editorial in the Daily Express says, that is very unlikely. Have you ever tried getting money from a Scotsman? Mm. Can you imagine?
Yeah. So that must have boosted circulation in Scotland for the Daily Express.
Yeah. You can blame all this for the Scottish independence movement. Anyway, yes. So this is a complete massive segue. I didn't even answer the question. My favourite World Cup is 1986, Tony. So
yeah.
Maradona, hand of God.
All that kind
England
of stuff.
England did well.
Yeah. Lineker's hat trick against Poland, the first half.
Handle with Claire asks a really good question, Tom, to you. Basically, it's why don't people play football? Why is it not so popular? I mean, if they do play it in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, I don't know, India, South Africa.
They don't really, yeah.
Why not? Why is it cricket rugby?
I don't know.
Okay. We don't know everything. I don't know either.
Simple as that. Don't know. But I'll tell you one interesting way that Australia has impacted on the history of football, Dominic.
Yeah.
Is that it was in Australia that they began the practice of putting numbers on the back of football shirts. Did you know that?
Is that so? No, I didn't know that.
So the first time it happened was in 1911, when a football team from Sydney took on a team from the brilliantly named ship in the Royal Navy, HMS Powerful.
Sydney versus Powerful.
Yeah, brilliant. Which is a great name for a ship.
It is.
And so it gradually spread, and 1928, so 2 years before the first World Cup, it reached the professional league in England.
Yeah.
And then it spread from that. So well done, Australia.
That is a good fact.
And I got that fact, again, from How Britain Brought Football to the World, which is this book by the Laycocks that I mentioned.
Yes.
And which basically will answer that question. So you could look up India, South Africa, New Zealand, and it will kind of tell you the patterns. But is there a general explanation? I don't know. I mean, Australia is obsessed by every kind of sport, isn't it?
It is, and brilliant at sports.
But a bit like America, it's invented its own version of a kind of football, rugby, whatever, kind of fusion. A bit like Ireland as well, because Ireland didn't really get into football until the 1990 World Cup.
No, that's right. Although Irish people had always followed English football, so they'd often had teams.
But they generally go over and play in England.
In England, of course, exactly.
I mean, I think that in India and Australia, cricket serves as the national game.
Yeah.
And in South Africa and New Zealand, rugby serves as the national game. And maybe there isn't the room.
This is my theory, Tom. There's a certain amount of kind of, as it were, cultural space. So in a given culture, it could be music, it could be, or particular genres of music, it could be, you know, I don't know, film or whatever. But in sport,
there's only so much bandwidth, isn't there?
There's only so much bandwidth, exactly. Schools can only do so much sport. A small town can support a small number of sporting clubs. So in the United States, for example, you know, American football, baseball, for example, they are so deeply embedded in the national imagination and then in the civic life of an American town. If you go to sort of rural Texas and try to set up a soccer club, I mean, you're competing with clubs.
But that's why it's been so successful for girls, isn't it?
Yes, agreed.
Because there's less of a kind of inheritance.
And it has, I think, in the United States, and I'll be really interested to know what our American listeners say. I think it clearly is a game of immigrants. So Mexican, Central American immigrants, for example. But it's also a game, it's a slightly hipsterish game, isn't it? Soccer. So if you read, the New York Times has a kind of soccer blog. And in my mind, that is read by people with beards in Williamsburg or wherever, with their bikes that they fold up or whatever they do, and craft beers and stuff.
Well, Dominic, so here's a question for you. What is the next World Cup that the United States will be hosting?
Well, I would say the Football World Cup, but I'm guessing you're asking me because it's not.
It's not. So that
surely not the Cricket World Cup, Tom.
So the United States is co-hosting the next Football World Cup, isn't it?
Yeah, with Canada and Mexico.
With Canada and Mexico. So that will be in 2026.
Yes, exactly.
But in 2024, the United States with the West Indies will be hosting the Cricket T20 World Cup.
Really? And where will they play in America?
I'm not entirely sure, but I'm just looking at a press release and they're saying that one of the reasons for having it there, it's to accelerate cricket's drive towards mainstream status in the USA and to enhance cricket's prospects of inclusion in the Los Angeles 2028 Olympic Games.
Wow.
Huge excitement.
They don't play much cricket in California, surely. Expats play, don't they?
There was a team that came from the very rundown, the notorious that they always rapping about?
Compton.
Yeah. Compton. They had a cricket team in Compton.
Did they?
That came over. Yeah, they did.
From the Caribbean, presumably.
No, it wasn't. It was for kind of, you know, people from the streets. Right. And it was set up as a way of teaching them to play a straight bat and
yeah, fair play.
All that kind of stuff. Fair play.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly. And they came on a tour to England about 10 years ago. I mean, it was all a bit of a gimmick.
Right. Okay. You didn't play them with the authors.
No,
so your authors team, Tom, who established that again?
Conan Doyle.
Brilliant. I mean, I don't like cricket, but that I would play cricket for Conan Doyle's team.
For the chance to play Conan Doyle, yeah.
If Conan Doyle were still playing, not for you.
Oh, Dominic, there's always a place for you. Right. Should we head on to...
Alfred.
To Alfred.
Yes. So, Klaz, did Alfred invent time off at Christmas? This was what he was told at school, or she was told at school.
I have never heard that.
Right. Okay, well, there you go. Also, not to sound like Dan Jackson, but apparently northeastern dialects contain a great percentage of Anglo-Saxon words, given our sporadic isolation from the rest of England as the English language developed. Words like gan instead of go are from the Anglo-Saxon, and so I propose the next screen of iteration of Alfred the Great be played by a Geordie for the Bants, says Klaz.
Yeah, well, I think it's...
For the accent.
Well, we know that there's a special relationship between St. Cuthbert and Wessex.
So a Geordie.
Yeah.
So what about Jimmy Nail? Could he...
I think Dan Jackson would be great.
Yeah, well, Dan's a great man for his hats. So.
Well, he's a star of, he's been on TV. He has
for Cheryl Cole.
Yeah.
Sorry, this will mean nothing to our international listeners, but there you go. Amy Mantravardi says, fun fact, Port Meadow in Oxford was set apart as a grazing space by King Alfred and remains a green space to this day.
It does, doesn't it? Got cows.
I've been on Port Meadow many times. I didn't know King Alfred had any association with it, so I'm delighted to hear that. Now, Morten Kasperson, a serious question, Tom. Interesting that the Vikings were described as slave traders, which they definitely were, but no word was spoken of Anglo-Saxon society as a slave economy, which it definitely was. Apparently, according to Mark Morris, the name for the Britons practically became synonymous with the word for a slave. Tom, shed light on this, please.
Well, I don't think we've avoided that. In the episode we did on 1066,
oh, yeah.
One of the things we talked about was how the Norman Conquest does effectively end slavery in England. Anglo-Saxon was definitely a slave society. But the Vikings, a bit like the Arabs or the Europeans in Africa, stimulate the locals to participate in the slave trade. So,
yeah.
I mean, interestingly, Bristol becomes the great center of the slave trade in England, you know, centuries and centuries before the Atlantic period. And the slaves are being basically taken there by English people, sold to Vikings, who then take them to Spain and to North Africa. It provokes one of the great homilies of Anglo-Saxon England by Wulfstan, who is Archbishop of York, who condemns this trade because, I think, not specifically because he's opposed to slavery as an institution, but because he's opposed to Christians being taken into slavery.
Right.
And he's saying, you know, Christian English, why are you enslaving your fellow Christians?
Sure, Tom, I've never been to Bristol in daylight.
Have you not?
I've been in the evenings. I've spoken to the Historical Association in Bristol.
Bristol's great.
I gave a talk, and plausibly, you may think, with Peter Tatchell, the heroic gay rights campaign.
So was that about the Bermondsey election?
No, it was about the legacy of the 60s.
Oh, interesting. Did you agree or not?
No, we didn't agree at all. And actually, he was charm itself. About halfway through the hour, the audience loved him and absolutely despised me, I think is fair.
Right. Well, they would in Bristol.
They would in Bristol, exactly. So I knew my part in the I knew my absolute.
Boo hiss.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. About halfway through, he went into what was almost like, it was like someone had flicked a switch. And apropos of nothing, he went on a massive rant about homophobia in the Church of England.
I remember you talking about this.
Yeah, it was completely irrelevant. It was like someone had turned a button and he went into sort of, perhaps he'd just forgotten what to say and just fell back on a tried and trusted favourite. But then at the end, he greatly impressed my parents who'd come to see the talk and clearly was sort of thinking, oh God, how awful that our son is playing the part of this
stooge.
Yeah, the stooge to Peter Tatchell. And I don't think had a massively high opinion of Peter Tatchell. They weren't sort of left-wing Labour voters, put it that way. And afterwards he came up and he was very polite to them. He was charming. In fact, he was more than polite. He was charming and friendly.
Yeah, he's a very admirable man.
Well, I always say brave of him, He is the one person who's alive right now in Britain who...
So we should explain for overseas listeners. He's Australian originally, wasn't he? He fought in a famous Bermondsey by-election in 1983. He was standing for Labour.
Yeah.
And there was a very overtly homophobic campaign against him.
Yeah.
Run by the Liberals, who then went on to win.
Yeah.
Since then, he's campaigned for gay rights, not just in Britain, but around the world, and taken on some very unsavory regimes, including Putin's Russia. And he's just been over in Qatar, I've seen.
Yeah.
I think he's been deported. He's a very, very brave man. Got beaten up by Mugabe's
thugs. Yeah. He lives in a flat surrounded by pieces of paper, sort of living in off tins of baked beans.
Has no money.
And a sort of genuinely, you know,
saintly figure.
16th or 17th century figure. Yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Anyway,
yes.
Producers are saying Tom's got to go in 4 minutes. So
yes, I have.
We should end with the last question, which Sam, our backroom boy, has asked, which is, who's going to win the World Cup? Tom.
I have no idea.
Come on, Tom.
I don't know.
Choose a country.
Lineker himself said it's the most open cup.
Choose a country.
Oh, Germany.
Okay, I'm going to say Argentina.
Or Argentina or Brazil.
I'm going to say Argentina.
Or France.
Please not
or
France.
Or England.
Not France. Tom, so evasive.
No,
I'm
Germany.
Surprised you don't. I'm surprised you didn't end by saying, "Well, the World Cup basically makes its own morality, so I can't."
Dominic,
that's the standard Holland evasion tactic.
I don't care because England have already won the World Cup, the T20. It's a great triumph.
On that bombshell, we will see you all next time. There are a billion podcasts coming out in the next few weeks.
Yeah,
there's Qatar. There is what else are we doing? Germany is coming.
Australia,
Costa Rica. Loads of
the Costa Rican Civil War.
Dr. Valverde.
Probably after Pigeons.
Yeah.
The best episode we've ever done.
All right. Well, have fun. Thank you so much to all of you who came on Saturday night. Thank you to all of you who came on Sunday. We really appreciate it. And we will see you sometime soon, I hope. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.